where does inspiration come from? Some people need a muse, others need to be left alone.
I think what I'm able to create by myself is somehow more interesting than what I could do with my band. I was getting set for my
accidental suicide. I'm Kurt Anderson. Today in Studio 360, musicians, writers, and artists who need solitude to create. Or maybe just because they're cranky.
You know, it's like people say, I love you. And then you say, okay, you love me. What else you got?
To
everything,
to make sure we don't get too lonely, though, later in the program I'll visit with the ultimate extrovert, Dolly Parton. Her new album covers all kinds of classic anti-war songs.
I'm not protesting anything, but we do have a voice and we should be able to say what we feel. A time of
hate, a time of war. That's all ahead in Studio 360, right after this.
PRI's Studio 360 is made possible in part by a grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson.
Eleanor Rigby picks up the rice in the church where a wedding has been.
Take it from John Lennon and Paul McCartney. Being all alone can be a real drag. For the most popular pop band ever, the Beatles sure could record some bleak stuff. Eleanor Rigby is a hard look at the lives of two people who work in a church and have nobody to come home to. And there's something strangely unsympathetic about the song. Paul's line, "Where do they all belong?" hints that maybe lonely people like this could be sent somewhere where we don't have to worry about them. But not everybody thinks that being alone is a curse. In fact, some of the people we'll hear from over the next hour require solitude to create their best work. Today in Studio 360, we're talking about being alone, its pleasures as well as its hazards. Joining me is the writer Jonathan Lethem. He won huge acclaim a few years ago for Motherless Brooklyn, and his most recent novel is The Fortress of Solitude, about a boy growing up as the only white kid on his block of 1970s Brooklyn. He also has a collection of essays out right now. Jonathan Lethem, welcome to Studio 360.
Hi, Kurt. Thanks for having me.
Now, you called your most recent novel The Fortress of Solitude after Superman's hideout up near the North Pole.
Yeah.
How come?
Well, I always was sort of fascinated and amused by the idea of the Fortress of Solitude, because here's Superman, who's sort of the most popular guy in the world, and he needs this place up in the Arctic to go and sort of lick his wounds and brood and walk the hallways of this giant empty fortress and talk to himself, which is what he does up there. And the fact that even Superman kind of needed to sulk a lot and needed to have this special place to go and do it struck me as revealing of something incredibly petulant and, I guess, self-pitying in the image of the superhero and, of course, the image of the teenager who adores a superhero.
Now, your novel, Fortress of Solitude, seems autobiographical. How was your life as a boy like or different than the hero, your hero Dylan's?
Well, I mean, it's interesting that you asked that question in this framework of solitude, because the biggest differences across the board are that I increased the isolation of the character. You know, he's a single son of being raised by a single father. I was actually, you know, I grew up in a family with siblings, and I had a mom much later into my childhood than the main character of the book. So I've reduced his options for contact.
Dylan lost his mother as a, I think, 10-year-old in your book. You lost your mother much later. Did that, however, become a kind of the transformative event of your young adulthood?
Well, my first few novels all center around some enormous missing piece, whether it's language or you know, there's a kind of amnesiac loss of memory that's a condition that the characters suffer. And as I worked on my fourth and fifth novels, I realized I was moving closer and closer to writing about a personal condition of losing a parent. But I'm not sorry in a way that I circled around that main subject for so long, because I think what matters to me about my own loss, paradoxically, is that it's connected to universal feelings of, you know, disconnection or suffering, and that in a funny way, I was handed this enormous subject matter.
Uh-huh.
My mother died of cancer slowly while I was turning 11, 12, 13, and 14 when she finally died, same year I began high school. But in some way, I think experiencing that loss only increased a pre-existing feeling for a condition of having lost something. Growing up in New York in the 1970s, I was very sensitive to the feeling that the world itself had suffered some kind of fundamental displacement or loss. My parents, who were radicals, had grown up protesting in the civil rights era and then protesting the Vietnam War. And even though both of those battles had been won in some sense, there was something in the mid-70s that felt very much like a kind of loss of possibilities mm-hmm. for the counterculture. And I was so sensitive to this idea that great things fell apart that I think when my own family fell apart because of my mother's illness and then death, it seemed to me only the natural course of things.
Jonathan Lethem is my guest today. We are talking about being alone. Our first story is about a musician named Andrew Bird, whose music I absolutely adored when I first heard it. And from the sweet, lonely sound of it, I wasn't surprised to learn that he plays every instrument himself. What's more, I found out a few years ago, he created his own fortress of solitude. He moved from Chicago to a rural farm, isolated from other musicians, even from music on the radio, and he found his music developing in ways that he hadn't expected.
The barn is situated on 350 acres of rolling hills and limestone cliffs and springs and forests. It's really close to the Mississippi River, so it's kind of where the glaciers sort of mist. And there's corn and soybeans and chickens. It was crazy. When I moved out there, I drove out there in a snowstorm in late February, and there was no one out there. And the barn wasn't quite finished, and I was loading in all my stuff, and I went out to the chicken shack, and the sun had just gone down. It was kind of like that purplish sky, and it was snowing, and there was a peacock sitting on the back of my grandpa's 73 Chevy pickup truck. And I've never seen a peacock again since I've been there. It was a weird way to start this whole, like, kind of 3-year antisocial adventure. I felt like I needed a place to get away and to work. What it ended up being is, like, this sort of self-imposed vacuum. Like, let's see what happens when I stop listening to records, I move out into the middle of nowhere, and have this space to experiment and let melodic ideas come out of wherever they come out of. I feel like the melodies and the arrangements since I've been out there and reflecting the landscape too just sort of opened up. When I spend too much time at the barn, the creative process slows down and I'm writing less songs, but I'm getting deeper in those songs. But I'm aware of, like, that things have kind of been grinding to a slower pace since I've been out there just in my own head. I think what I'm able to create by myself is somehow more interesting than what I could do with the band right now. I both have this, like, isolation to work and experiment, but I also go straight from that experimentation and working with myself straight to a stage now with the solo show. Whereas before I'd have to, you know, schedule rehearsals with my band and kind of go through this negotiation of sort of letting go of your songs. Really who I interact with now instead of a band is the audience. A lot of times I'll play a half-finished song for the audience and, like, as if to ask them what they think, you know. That's replaced my band, really. I think the lyrics have gotten a lot more like internal conversations. Like Lull, for instance, became like the theme about someone who's trying to convince themselves that it's cool to be alone. Being alone can be quite romantic, like Jacques Cousteau, Underneath the Atlantic.
Being alone, it can be quite romantic, like Jacques Cousteau, Underneath the Atlantic, a fantastic.
And then there's a completely ridiculous line, which is embarrassing and self-conscious, but became so true. I'm rambling on rather self-consciously, stirring these condiments into my tea, and I think I'm so lame, I bet I think this song is about me. Don't I?
I'm so lame, but I think the song is about me. Don't I?
ultimately, when I was out there, I had to convince myself that being alone, though sometimes necessary, really, you can convince yourself that it's romantic, if that makes you feel better. It was this sort of extreme experiment, and it was really cool, and all this cool stuff came out of it. But, you know, in many cultures, moving out and being isolated and from everyone else is like a fate worse than death, you know? And there I was out there just kind of obsessing over that idea. Like, what? Why am I out here? What drove me to live in a barn by myself in the middle of nowhere? So all the while I knew that there was going to come a time when I had to come back and re-engage and play with musicians again. And that time has finally come. So...
Andrew Bird will be back on tour starting in November, and you can find out about his shows and hear some more of his music at studio360.org. Jonathan Menjivar produced our story. I'm Kurt Anderson. In a minute, I'll talk more with Jonathan Lethem, and we'll hear a man coming to terms with his father, who really wants to be left alone.
I don't care what other people think about me because it's not important.
That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International. Stay with us. This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. The novelist Jonathan Lethem is my guest this hour, and we're talking about being alone. Our next story is about an artist, Bob Paul, who would rather keep everyone in the world at arm's length. His son, Richard Paul, thinks that solitude, like his dad's, is a little like an addictive drug. The more you get, the less you can cope without it.
What do you say about this guy, my father? An accomplished graphic artist, successful enough to have put three kids through college, a man who no one trained.
I taught myself how to do it.
A man whose art helped sell the NBA and Canadian lottery tickets, and who paints watercolors so vivid you'd swear you're looking at a photograph. A man whose self-regard and professional success have created such a monumental self-confidence that he doesn't feel he has to care what his clients think. He's so good, he knows they'll be back.
You ought to hear me talk to some of these clients. They're hysterical because nobody would dare talk to them that way. You know, I tell them things like, what are you wasting my time for?
Say that to a client.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. More often than not, I laugh at these guys right to their face. And sometimes they respect that.
And what happens when they don't?
When they don't, you find another client.
But despite all this faith in his talent, when it comes to his art, my dad is surprisingly level-headed about what he can accomplish.
Do you consider yourself an artist?
I'm a schmearer. An artist is somebody who can take a blank canvas, take something out of his head, and paint it. I paint things that I like. But I'm not passionate. I mean, my idol was Vincent van Gogh, and that's a painter. I look at Renoir, and he worked alone, too. Most of these guys did.
I hope you caught that last part, because it's a key thing to say about my dad. He is a man who works alone.
I don't care what other people think about me because it's not important. And if they don't get it, like you don't get it about who I am, then, you know, I'm sorry you don't get it, but it's not interfering in my life anyway.
What if nobody gets it? Then where are you?
Who cares? It's out of my hands.
But see, you say that, but you said you...
Whose interview is this? Is this your interview or mine? See, you got that look on your face. You're starting already.
My dad has always had two dreams, and for most of his life, he's been living them out. He always wanted to work in advertising, and he always wanted to do things his way.
Why? I don't know why. Probably because I was an only child. Why did I want to work alone? I don't know.
Whatever the reason, he never quite fit in at his first job at a small ad agency.
No matter what I did, their attitude was they knew more than I did. You know, in those days, I was a lot younger. I would say, well, why don't we try this? No, no, we can't do that. What do you guys think? Oh, boy. And I got so sick and tired of that I decided, you know, I had to be on my own.
Since then, starting in the attic of the house I first grew up in, he has worked by himself with no input from anyone.
Do you see any downsides to working the way that you've worked all these years?
Sometimes my work turns out, for the moment, to be more important than my family around me. And some of my family members are not willing to accept that.
But if my dad was absorbed in his work, he wasn't exactly ignoring us. In fact, he was teaching us lessons all the time. In our house, advice wasn't just offered. It was more like a hose was stuck in your ear and someone turned on the advice spigot. No, I received lessons from my father, and I learned them all too well. It's why, for years, I had no trouble expressing my opinion.
Virtually everybody in the top echelon in business is stupid.
But why I had such a hard time expressing any positive emotions.
You know, it's like people say, I love you. I love you. And then you say, okay, you love me. What else you got?
And why I grew up utterly confident that whatever I was doing was the right thing.
If they don't like your work, fine. They don't like me. I don't care about that either.
I learned from him all the things that made me who I am today. I can't tell you the number of times I've almost been fired, the hours I spent learning anger management. Today, I work alone.
Are we going to discuss your childhood or my career? I don't understand this.
Though, unlike him, I don't like it. When I see my dad these days, which isn't often, we always seem to have the same fight.
Why is that?
I know why. But
why?
I know why.
Why?
You have no patience.
Worst one we ever had. I was working for a university, and he was all over me. What are you working for someone else for? I told him I did it because it makes me happy. To which he said, there's more to life than happiness. See, for my dad, independence trumps everything else, even having other people appreciate what you do. I asked him about his watercolors. They are so good, people used to buy them right off the wall of a fancy restaurant in Connecticut until he stopped letting them.
It becomes a hassle. I don't know what to charge for them because I really, really enjoy them.
So today, he's the only one that gets to see them. They line the walls of his houses in Connecticut and Vermont, his office, even his garage. But believe it or not, they bring him no satisfaction. I know because I asked him if his paintings or anything he's done artistically makes him feel satisfied creatively.
I don't know. I can't answer a question like that.
Wait a minute. What about that painting of the old barn with the glorious, angry sky that's so real you can almost smell the rot and feel the humidity and the danger? Or the one of Mom looking into a window that's so lifelike, I literally had to walk right up to it and look at the brush strokes to realize it wasn't a photograph. What do you mean there's nothing that stands out?
It's never really been that important. That's something you have to understand.
What has been?
Trying to create the most successful thing for yourself.
You're trying to create the most creative thing for yourself? It's not important?
You don't understand. You're interviewing me. My life is based on what I'm working on now. That's hard for you to understand. But when you work by yourself, that's a rationale that you evolve and develop.
My father has given me so many things. I have his eye and his business acumen. He gave me tenacity, and he taught me the value of a dollar. And While I do value my independence, I've learned one more lesson from my father. If you go through life pleasing yourself without thinking of others, in the end, you risk living with the empty feeling that really, you've pleased no one at all. For Studio 360, I'm Richard Paul.
A child arrived just the other day. He came to the world in the usual way, but there were planes to catch and bills to pay. He learned to walk while I was away, and he was talking for I knew it, and as he grew, he'd say, I'm gonna be like you, Dad, you know I'm gonna be like you. And the cats in the cradle and the silver spoon, little boy blue and the man on the moon, when you're coming home, Dad, I don't know when.
You can see some of Bob Paul's watercolors at studio360.org. The novelist Jonathan Lethem is my guest today. I'm Kurt Anderson, and we're talking about being alone in various senses. It was amazing to me, I don't know about you, to have such an intimate look inside this sad and funny relationship between father and son.
Yeah, it was quite a gift to be let into those conversations and. Bob's directness is to be envied.
Also, where I really found it bordering on the almost strange is the fact that he gets no pleasure out of having other people even look at or buy or admire his work.
Yeah, it's fascinating. But I also think that he's maybe typical of the person who made a choice to do commercial art or advertising at some point, mm-hmm. who still remembers a time when they might have tried to be Van Gogh and isn't kidding himself.
That seems like a fair take. The fact that he is eschewing ambition altogether, not showing and not selling his work, is part of that kind of lifelong demural, I guess.
It strikes me as a kind of honesty about which kind of artist he chose to be. And what makes him so fascinating, I don't want to presume because he really is a conundrum, but in a way he's combined the mercilessness and the kind of indomitable selfishness of a great artistic talent,
yes.
The kind of willfulness that you associate with
Picasso or something.
Exactly, with a Picasso, with this very rigorous humbleness. He's not making any claims, actually, and he's not interested in any pretense that he's accomplished anything that a genius might.
Your father was an artist, a visual artist. Did watching him as you grew up teach you anything about working by yourself happily?
Sure. I mean, I had such a huge head start. When I talked to other writers and artists, you know, making yourself into a writer, deciding that it's okay to spend your days that way, that it's not some esoteric or impossible kind of stance in life, is very difficult for people. But I had this enormous head start because I had the example of my father right at hand. He had a very healthy, still has a very healthy studio practice. He loves to work. He's very patient with himself. He's very forgiving. He's in the studio a lot of his time. You know, he makes it a comfortable, inviting place. You know, it's not an ascetic or monk-like place. It's more a part of normal human commerce. There's coming and going. He invites you in. He has books to read. He's a very natural artist in the sense of the relationship to the activity is very natural.
How do you feel yourself as a writer, as an artist, in relation to Bob Paul's kind of absolute defiance of what the world thinks? That there's nobody to please but yourself. It doesn't matter if people don't get it. It doesn't matter if people don't like it. I mean, that's a matter of balance, I would expect, in any artist's career of listening to your own muse but not going off some deep end.
Yeah. What he said that I related to instantly was that there's no satisfaction except in the work at hand, that it's very hard to rest on your laurels with any pleasure at all. But I've never been a writer who kept a journal because I'm not very interested in writing that isn't meant somehow to communicate, that isn't part of a possible conversation with a reader.
So even as you're writing, there is a sense in your head that you're writing for somebody. So I guess that mitigates the ultimate sense of solitude in the act of writing.
Sure. Well, you're communing with your possible readers. Often you have one or two particularly wonderful targets in mind, someone you want to impress, whether you know they'll read the book or not. You know, when I wrote The Fortress of Solitude, I spent half the time thinking, this is meant to knock Philip Roth's socks off. And I have no idea whether I've ever had the luck of being read by Philip Roth. And it doesn't matter. Thinking of him possibly reading me was part of how I got to where I needed to be in writing that book. But you also are communing with your characters. And the other antidote to the loneliness of writing fiction is you're with these people that, if you're doing a good job, they've got a kind of uncanny interest in you. They they read you back. They want to please you. They want to annoy you. They want to get your attention. And, you know, one of the things I sometimes feel guilty about is just how much fun I'm having communicating with these imaginary presences.
Jonathan Lethem is my guest today. I'm Kurt Anderson, and we are talking about being alone in music and fiction and now on the stage. One of the most exciting new plays I've seen in a while features a single man on a minimal set just talking. It's called Tom Paine, and it's by a young playwright named Will Eno. This Tom Paine is no relation to the 18th century revolutionary, although the truth is we can't really tell much for sure about who this man on the stage is. He's constantly revising his opinions and his portrayal of himself. But Tom is a witty guy, and his morbid humor and quirky charm keep us with him as he explores some of the darker corners of the soul. I spoke with Will Eno, the man who wrote Tom Paine, as well as James Urbaniak, the actor who played the role when it first opened in New York. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Now, before we talk, I would like you, James, to give our listeners a sense of the play, if you would. If you could start out with a bit of the performance as
sure.
Tom Paine.
I'm looking out at the audience, and I say, what a nice crowd. I see no difference, really, in a world filled with difference, sickening, disheartening difference. I see none between the you and the me. You all seem so wonderful, and I seem so wonderful, and so I make no distinction. I see no separation, no unbridgeable distance between us, wonderful us, or none worth remarking, since the thought of you disgusts me so much. The thought of you doesn't disgust me that much. In fact, you're all so wonderful, I'd like to take you home. Leave you there and then go somewhere else. No, seriously, the truth? I don't care either way. That's not true. I do care. Either way. I'm the type of person you might not hear from for some time, but then suddenly one day, bang, you'd never hear from me again. We're all roughly this way, yes? Roughly?
Very nicely done. James, you begin as this kind of charming master of ceremonies character, and that kind of self-confident facade begins showing cracks and then some. Even though he's playing one character, various sides of a persona from strong to weak to pathetic to charming come out in the course of the hour.
It's a beautifully written and wonderfully structured play. And actually, although at first glance it appears to be the character seems to be rather confusing, he loses his place, he appears to be a man having a breakdown. Through the course of the evening, especially as an actor especially, but I think for the audience as well, one realizes it's actually a rather traditionally structured play. At the end, he sort of brushes himself off, and he's a different person than he was at the beginning. The character appears to be sort of lost in a kind of random state. But the writing is far from random. It's actually very precise and really quite traditionally structured, I think, in a way.
Does it spoil you, do you think, doing ensemble pieces?
Well, I think it spoils me for the future of my acting career. I think, you know, when you work on something that you're really proud of and the material is so exciting.
And the New York Times says this is the greatest play of the decade.
Those experiences are few and far between in show business.
Will, do you find that your temperament as a person who is willing to spend hours and hours a day alone in a room making things up and writing lines suits what you do, or would you rather be out actually with actors putting the play up?
I like being alone and writing, and I've sort of lucked out in that way, I think. I just had read something, Howard Barker, the English dramatist, and he wrote a great little bit about why it happens in the dark, why do plays happen in the dark. And it's sort of a revision of what we most tend to believe, which is that we're all together. When we turn out the lights, we're all this community sitting together and united in the darkness. But his point was that, in fact, we are all sitting separately, suffering alone in the darkness. And it is something that I tried to enable, in a way, with this play, is just to help people feel alone. It sounds sort of crazy, but I would hope that an audience member might feel one's difference, feel one's separation, if not loneliness, if not solitude, but at least just the physical separation from people.
Do you wish that you had James's ability as a performer to be able to just to write the words and get up there and do it yourself and do it all?
I guess I do wish that, but I don't have that, so I'm happy to...
The next best thing is having this guy who does it really well.
It's very nice. I'd said somewhere before once, I sort of feel like the shyer, pimplier kid in high school who keeps saying to his braver, more outgoing buddy, hey, go over and do that. Go say this to that guy and go push him down the stairs and trip that guy. And it's a very nice feeling to sit. I watch from up in the booth there, and it's a sort of sneaky feeling to be having put this in motion.
Now, James Urbaniak, I am not going to let you leave this studio until you perform a little more from the play.
Trust me. There are people out there who don't love you, who don't love you enough to spit on your little hopes, so as to leave you all alone, respectfully and truly alone, with your larger ones, your larger hopes, which are what? Sir, care to share your larger hopes with us? No? That's fine, I understand. Don't want to jinx anything, or have nothing to jinx, or can't feel hope, or don't like sharing. Oh, the varieties of experience. Feel free to feel anything. Religious ecstasy, anarchy, shivery, physical things, nothing, blood, your neighbor, that stranger you married. What possibilities we all have here. Ways and means to live and die. Cancer, for example, or depression. Political intrigue, anxiety, insecurity, holes in your knowledge, spots on your lungs, total oblivion. More, financial crisis. Outer space, inner peace, shame. Lust, war, me, hate, you, hate, words, love, nothing more, migraine, you, God, the things you may be feeling, the list goes on. Then the list ends.
James Urbaniak, Will Eno, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Will Eno's play, Tom Paine, is running through the end of the year at the DR2 Theater in New York City. I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360. And Jonathan Lethem is here talking with me today about solitude. Jonathan, have you happened to have seen Tom Paine yet?
I haven't. I'm dying to, and those glimpses make me even more eager. And I'm very compelled by his description of the darkness in the theater. I think about that not just as a playgoer, but as a filmgoer, that there's this very interesting tension between the collective space of an audience and the kind of skull of a darkened movie theater, which is like the interior dream space for each individual watcher. It's a very selfless place to be, and then it can be very suddenly quite intimate and personal.
The book you're working on now is a comic novel, and I'm wondering how you think about the reader's experience for that, because it's very different sitting alone reading a funny book than sitting in a theater full of people, all of whom are laughing at the same scene.
Well, what I relish in funny novels, and a lot of my favorite novels are funny, it may not be the only thing that they're doing, but is a kind of humor that can't be conveyed easily. You wish in the middle of a funny scene to turn to your friend or loved one and say, listen to this, and then you try to read them the line, but it's so dependent on so much context that you can't reproduce the situation. That, to me, is what it is to be funny in a novel, whereas there were lines in that Will Eno play that they're so epigraphically funny you could almost imagine, you know, putting them on a T-shirt, which is to take nothing away from the accomplishment of the play. But You've also got me thinking about what it is to stand in front of an audience. It's almost irresistible not to read the funniest parts of whatever you've written because you want to hear something coming back from the audience. You want to feel that you've moved them or activated them in some way. And this question of whether or not they're going to laugh is so vital. And it's to me, as a public reader, it's usually decided in the first few sentences whether or not they're going to sit there soberly, no matter how uproarious you think you're being, or whether there'll be something infectious. And that's that social laughter.
Do you like reading? Do you like the performance aspect of this usually private art?
I've come to like it. I'm not a particularly shy person. And so though I treasure the solitude that's the majority of my work, I kind of like its antidote too. I like the tonic of going out and very briefly trying to make it play in front of a crowd and feel the presence of my audience.
Jonathan Leatham, thanks very much for joining us today in Studio 360.
Thank you, Kurt.
Jonathan Leatham is the author of The Disappointment Artist, The Fortress of Solitude, and Motherless Brooklyn, among other books. You can find out more about him at studio360.org. Coming up, the one, the only Dolly Parton.
And I remember being in town with my mom one time, and I said, oh, she is so pretty. She is so beautiful. And Mom said, oh, she's just trash. And I thought, that's what I want to be when I grow up. I want to be trash. I don't hardly know you, but I think I could love you.
That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International. Stay with us.
See you come walking my way.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. On this show, we don't actually have very many guests of whom I can honestly give the cliched introductory line, someone who needs no introduction. But today we do. Dolly Parton.
But you better introduce me anyway.
Well, I'm about to. Almost half a century ago, she launched her country music career at age 10. But Dolly Parton didn't stop with country music. Over the years, she's become a movie star, a theme park impresario, a literacy activist, now a Broadway musical songwriter, and Jim Henson even made a Muppet out of her. Last year, the Library of Congress honored her as an official living legend. And her latest project is an album called Those Were the Days, which covers iconic songs from the 1960s and 70s. Dolly Parton, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you. I didn't even know all that stuff about me.
Well, then I guess you did need an introduction.
I guess I did.
Now, you have written literally thousands of songs.
Yeah, well, I've been at it since I was a little bitty kid, and I'm getting up there. And I write all the time, so that makes for a whole lot of songs.
So you're still writing?
Oh, yeah, I do it all the time.
But this album is all cover songs of songs people like us grew up listening to on the radio.
Yeah, the 60s and 70s was a great time. It was the sexual revolution. I still ain't sure who won, though, on that one. But these are songs that I've loved and that have touched me and that I used to actually sing before I had enough songs of my own that were recognized by people when I would do shows on the road.
Really?
I would do some of these songs because nobody ever has enough of their own and people like to hear recognizable songs. So I thought, well, I should actually do these songs.
You've said that this isn't an anti-war album or anything like that, or a protest album, but we're in a war, and a lot of these songs were written about the last big war we were in, Vietnam. That must have been in your mind as you were picking out the songs.
Yes, it was. Actually, I loved these songs, and I was singing them back then, but I've been singing them even when we weren't at war, because these songs are just good. And I'm a very patriotic person, and I don't believe that one should get out and protest when there's nothing we can do except send our sons and daughters off to war. We certainly need to be supporting them. But we do have a voice, and we should be able to, you know, say what we feel. And a lot of these songs really did. I'm not protesting anything, and you're right, we are at war. But as a singer and someone who longs for peace, I thought this was a good thing for me to do. And I felt like people would accept it from me in the spirit in which it was given, rather than thinking I'm out just trying to drive something down somebody's throat.
Well, it seems to me that one can be patriotic, one can even support the war, and still look at the tragedy of dying and of war and imagine and where have all the flowers gone and all the rest. You can sing one of those songs and still think that war is sometimes inescapable.
Well, it is. And the Bible even speaks of that. And one of the songs on the album is that Turn, Turn, Turn that Pete Seeger took from the Bible. But it kind of gives you hope, a song like that, because it even speaks of that, that for everything there's a season. There's a time of war, a time of peace, a time to kill, a time to die. So the Bible says that there'll always be wars and rumors of wars. And it's true. It would be great if we could all get along. It would be wonderful if we could live in peace. And those tenderhearted people like me long for it and wish for it, but also we know that that's not likely to happen.
To everything turn, 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 there is a season, turn, 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 and a time to every purpose under heaven. A time to be born, a time to die, a time to play.
Do you have a favorite track?
Well, I love Where Have All the Flowers Gone an awful lot, because I loved singing with Nora Jones and Leanne Womack. But I just love that song because it fits my voice really well. I love those kinds of songs, those old world Irishy kind of songs that kind of fit my voice well.
And your DNA, maybe.
And my DNA, yeah, it does. It goes back a long way.
Flowers gone. Young girls pick them, everyone. When will we ever learn? When will we ever learn? Where have all the young girls gone? Long time.
I really like that one. I love 12th of Never, getting to sing with Keith Urban. That's the only song that's not from the 60s and 70s. That's from the 50s, I think 57, when Johnny Mathis had that out. But I wanted a really beautiful love duet to sing with Keith. I didn't want to just...
Would you sing much more cheerfully and upbeat than Johnny Mathis did it?
Well, yeah, they say he did it as a prayer. But, of course, I wanted to have a little flavor to kind of Dollyize it. And to me, it was like some of the other things I had done on the past albums, Grass is Blue and Little Sparrow, where I took a few of the old songs, like Shine, and kind of put a little bluegrass flavor and a few things that would lend themselves well to that up-tempo where you play in a double time, but you kind of still sing it slow. I don't think it took away from the emotion of it, but it still kind of countrified it a bit and bluegrassed it just a little, but it stayed in a loving feeling, I thought. Or maybe I was just got a crush on Keith and just thought it sounded like that. Did to me.
You ask how much I need you, must I explain? I need you, oh my darling, like the roses need the rain. You ask how long I love you, I tell you true, until the 12th of never, I'll still be loving you.
Now, in addition to touring for this album, you are writing a score for a Broadway show.
Yes, they finally decided after all these years. 9 to 5 has been out. The movie came out 25 years ago, and as you know, I wrote the theme song. I was lucky and fortunate enough, my first movie, to get to write the song for it. But they asked me when they decided they were going to put it on Broadway if I would be interested in writing all the music for it. So I have written about 15 or 20 things. They've chosen for certain about 10 of those. So it's a work in progress, and it's a lot of work. I've never done anything like it, but it's a little bit different. But it's a challenge, and it's fun.
How is it different? How does that process work?
Well, you know, when you write songs for radio or for records, you usually will write, you have kind of like a little pattern. You'll write a verse, chorus, or a couple verses and a chorus and a bridge, and you have a time on it. But in the play, you kind of write what the action is, and it doesn't matter if you put a chorus before you do a verse, or if you write four verses and before you even do a chorus, or you never get to the chorus till very end of the play. Or you can be a little more raw, a little more honest. You don't have to rhyme it as much. You don't have to. It's not such a pattern. But somehow, it's like I've always done it. And this is more fun and easier for me than actually trying to write commercial songs for commercial records.
Really?
Yeah. It's been kind of fun because I get to act it out, because I have to be everybody, because I'm writing Mr. Hart. I have to be Mr. Hart.
If the bad guy, the good women, yeah, all the everybody.
And I'm everybody in the whole play when I'm writing it. So you'd get a kick if you was a fly on the wall seeing me have to get up and act out Mr. Hart when I'm doing his, you know, his part, or when I'm doing Lily's or Jane's, because I'm having to, you know, write for all of us and everybody in the whole play. I'm by myself because I thank God if somebody wants to see me, they'd think I lost my mind. I get up on the stairs, I try to act it out and see what I do. So I'm having a big time playing in it.
As I was getting ready to talk to you, I couldn't think of any other performer in my lifetime who is both so deeply authentic as a person, as a performer, and so flagrantly artificial at once. Is that, I mean, does that appeal to you? That
well, it must. I've been that all my life. I always said, if you know, there's must be some kind of a magic in the fact that I look totally artificial and that I'm totally real, because it's true. But you know what? My artificialness really comes from a sincere place. It was what a little country girl's idea of glamour was. And, you know, like my first impressions of people that I thought was pretty or beautiful, and we didn't have anything, and I certainly am no natural beauty, so if I got any looks at all, it's like something I painted on or bought. Or,
but Marilyn Monroe was the idea of feminine beauty when you were a kid.
Those types of people, but I had patterned my look after the town tramp in her own town. It's true. But it was, I'm sure she was influenced by the Marilyns and all, but I just loved the, you know,
literally a town
look.
Tramp in your town.
Yes, yes, and that's the truth. And it's still.
Was she ever aware of this homage?
Well, no, but she was. She was really beautiful. She was blonde. She had all that yellow hair. She wore tight skirts, and she had pretty legs. She wore high heels, and she even had a pair of shoes, high heel shoes that were plastic and had plastic goldfish in the heels. And to a little child, when we did get to go to town out of the mountains, I just remember just being in awe of her and her red lipstick and her nails. And I just remember saying, I remember being in town with my mama one time, and I said, oh, she is so pretty. She is so beautiful. And Mama said, oh, she's just trash. And I thought, that's what I want to be when I grow up. I want to be trash. Because I thought that was like a word meaning how you looked. So I grew up, and I was that. Not, I didn't become trash, but I looked like trash. But that is my look. I enjoy it. It makes me feel good. It, you know, and that's important. If I feel comfortable, then I'm comfortable to do my work. And it's like my work is a separate thing. But I have an outgoing personality, and that look just seems to fit me. And so it is looks artificial. I wrote one of the songs I wrote for the Broadway play. It's called Backwoods Barbie. It's about a girl, a country girl, that wanted to, you know, be beautiful more than anything in the world.
And when might we see that Broadway play of 9 to 5?
Supposed to be coming out in 2007.
I look forward to
it. In the fall of 2007, if they're on schedule.
Now, your career has had lots of different chapters and ups and downs. Are there moments when you feel like, well, the media, the public should have paid attention to that thing I did that was great? Why did I fall off the radar then?
No, you know what? I look at my life. I have been so fortunate and so lucky. Of course, you always wish you could stay on the charts. But you also know, I mean, look at all the great years I had, 20, 25 years. I mean, I was like really did well, and people were very kind to me. And new people come along. So you have to kind of move over. But I'm still very serious about my work. And I figure that if I continue to do good work, no matter how old I am, they will eventually pick it up and play some of it, at least here and there now and then. But as I've often said, I'll make my records even if I have to sell them out of the trunk of my car.
And it must be kind of freeing to be able to go and make a couple of bluegrass records that don't have to sell a million copies, or make these, you know, 60s songs that don't have to sell a million songs to your Nashville audience.
It's true, and I'm getting a lot out of that, because now I make jokes about it, and I've said it before that I've finally got rich enough to sing like I'm poor again and be able to afford it, because I own my own little label. I record all these things. I pay for them. I lease them, you know, to a label to distribute them, but I own them. They go back into my family's fund, you know, to my estate. And so I'm enjoying doing things like this particular album of songs I love. People, I want my fans to know the kind of stuff that I also like, not just that I wrote or, you know, so I'm really enjoying doing the bluegrass things, doing the mountain songs, because that's stuff I love. If I could have made a living doing that in the early days, I'd have probably just have done that type of stuff. So I'm not in it for the money now. I used to be in it for the money because I needed to make a living, but now I've been fortunate to have Dollywood and a lot of other business things. But still, my music is my first love. It was a song that brought me out of the mountains. It was a song that built Dollywood. It was a song that has done everything, either one I wrote or one I've sung or one or both. So I will never give up on the love for my music, and I will continue to do it from now on.
Dolly Parton, thanks very much for joining me in Studio 360 today.
Well, thank you for having me. It's always good to see you.
Dolly Parton's newest album is called Those Were the Days, and she's on tour right now all over America.
Busted flat in Baton Rouge, heading for a train, feeling nearly faded as my jeans. Bobby thumbed a diesel down.
I'm Kurt Anderson. Thanks very much for listening to Studio 360 today. I hope you'll join us for next week's show. Studio 360 is produced by WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Julie Burstein,
Carrie Hillman,
Arun Ra,
David Krasnow,
Lital Malad,
Michelle Siegel,
Abe Carrillo,
Eric Malinsky,
Sarah Lilly,
Derek John,
Caitlin Lindsay,
Amol Mathre,
Katie Gradowski.
And our theme music is by David Van Tegum.
Studio 360 is funded in part by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, we sail in search of the great white whale.
He rises!
It's been seen as the story of a fascist, the story of a totalitarian communist, and most recently, the story of a terrorist.
I'm Kurt Anderson. Join me as we chase Moby Dick next time in Studio 360 from PRI.